Penguin Random House Audio presents Flying Blind, The 737 MAX Tragedy and the Fall of Boeing by Peter Robison. Read for you by Fyodor Chin. Introduction. The scene before dawn at Soekarno-Hatta International Airport in Jakarta on October 29, 2018, was like that at any other big airport in the age of routinized international travel. In the concourses, bleary-eyed families and solo travelers clumped outside gates or gulped a hurried breakfast from Dunkin' Donuts or Burger King, the latter of which, in this majority Muslim country, offered a halal-certified rice and crispy chicken combo, the King Deal. Others window-shopped for Kiehl's face cream or electronic gadgets. As the sun rose, it was finally light enough to see the tropical gardens of Nara trees, palms, and orchids outside. One of the few clues the traveler wasn't in Kansas City or Stuttgart. Not many gave a thought to the machines parked beside the jetways, many of them Boeing 737s, the stub-nosed workhorses of airline fleets since the 1970s. Commercial aircraft are considered the world's premier expression of manufacturing excellence, designed by tens of thousands of people around the world who put their hands on them, at first figuratively, on the computer screens of engineers, and then literally, when machinists climb underneath them to hand-crank stubborn rivets to the desired torque. Before the planes leave Boeing's factory near Seattle, airlines send their own representatives to inspect every inch and reject the machines if they find, say, a loose bin or a fray in the 40 miles of wiring, or, as sometimes happens, a forgotten wrench or gum wrapper. The people gathered around Gate B5 that morning for Lion Air Flight 610 were about to board the newest and most advanced of more than 10,000 737s Boeing had manufactured. It was called the 737 MAX 8, a far cry from the original 737, which had two tiny cigar-shaped engines tucked under its wings. This one had two massive turbofans. Almost 6 feet in diameter, they were so big they had to be mounted in front of the wings instead of beneath them, and the average person could stand inside the cowlings. The engines generated 28,000 pounds of thrust, double that of the first 737 models, while drastically lowering fuel consumption. The new jetliner was economical enough that Lion Air could charge $60 for the one-hour flight from Jakarta to Pangkal Pinang, a city of 300,000 on Indonesia's Bangka Island. A Lion Air subsidiary, in fact, had been the first to fly the 737 MAX, which was particularly popular with Asian airlines springing up to transport the continent's millions of newly mobile middle-class travelers. One of them, Paul Iyer Baba, 43, sent his family a choppy WhatsApp video of his mundane walk through the jetway and out to the plane, painted a cheery orange and white. In the minutes before the doors closed, 22-year-old Daryl Fida Febrianto, a newlywed of 2 weeks, texted a selfie to his bride as he departed for a job on a cruise ship, while Hugh Aldila sat with his son, Jerdan Ferizi, after visiting Jakarta for a soccer match. A grieving family, Michelle Fergina Boncal, 21, her father, Adonia, and brother Matthew, 13, was heading to Bangka Island for the funeral of Michelle's grandmother. 20 employees of the country's finance ministry, returning from a weekend in Jakarta, had caught the early morning flight to reach the office in time. Taking the MAX through a pre-flight checklist, the pilot, Bafiye Sunija, typified a new generation of pilots across Asia. At 31, he had already flown 6,000 hours, almost all of them on previous versions of the 737. His co-pilot, who went by the single name Harfino, was a decade older and had about 5,000 hours. Neither knew that a tiny sensor on the left side of the plane, just below Sunija's window, had a 21-degree misalignment in its delicate innards, an oversight by mechanics who had inspected it. The device, known as an angle of attack sensor, was basically a weather vane. It measured the angle of the wing against the oncoming air. Too high, and the plane might stall. In the triple redundant engineering of a product now more than a century old, dating to a pair of bicycle makers who hitched a 12-horsepower engine and a chain sprocket to a spruce wood frame. It wasn't even considered a particularly relevant indicator on most airplanes. Other dials measured the all-important airspeed, altitude, and pitch. It was 6:20 a.m. when Lion Air 610 departed the runway. The nose gear had barely left the ground when Suneja's control column began shaking, the cue for a potential stall. Two alerts signaling bad altitude and airspeed readings blinked on. Flight data recorders don't pick up the expressions on pilots' faces or the stab in their spines when they sense their docile machine might kill them. Harfino, the co-pilot, immediately asked the captain if he planned to turn around. Suneja suggested they get clearance to a holding point to buy some time. Flight control problem, Harfino radioed. As Suneja steered toward the new heading, the nose mysteriously dipped. He squeezed a switch on the control column under his thumb to push it back up. The nose lifted, but then it dipped again. For 8 minutes, the tug of war continued. The blue expanse of Jakarta Bay filled the windows. Harfino flipped through Boeing's quick reference handbook, searching through pages of emergency checklists for an answer. Airspeed, unreliable. Duct bleed. Pack trip off. Wing body overheat. Nothing seemed to explain the ghost fighting them for control of the plane. 21 times Suneja pressed the switch to keep the nose pointing up. The plane was cleared for 27,000 feet, but had reached less than 6,000. The fishing boats in the sea below, like toys in a tub. The passengers felt every sickening undulation in their stomachs. Suneja finally got on the phone to ask a flight attendant to come into the cockpit. "Yes, sir," she answered, replacing the phone with a ka-chunk, audible on the cockpit voice recorder, and opening the door. He asked her to send in a Lion Air engineer, who happened to be aboard, to help them figure out the problem. The chimes of the intercom sounded as she called him forward. Suneja, preparing to brief his colleague and probably wanting a look at the handbook himself, told his co-pilot to take over the controls. The nose dipped again. "Wow, it's very," Harfino muttered. He flicked the thumb switch, but not as firmly as the captain had. After a few seconds, the nose fell again, and again he hit the switch. The jet tilted toward the water. Harfino exclaimed that the plane was pointing down. Suneja, distracted, answered, "It's okay." 10 seconds later, they were plummeting at 10,000 feet a minute. Harfino pulled desperately on the control column, alarms blaring, "Sink rate, sink rate." The water was now immense and terrifying as the glare of early morning light streamed into the cockpit. The co-pilot began repeating, "Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar," the Muslim expression of faith meaning God is greater, and a harsh robotic voice intoned, "Terrain, terrain." Suneja was silent. At 6:32 a.m., the ghost won. Horrified fishermen on a nearby boat watched as the jet, carrying 189 people, hit the sea at a nearly vertical angle at 500 miles per hour. Television stations soon began broadcasting images of floating debris and interviewing the victims' stunned relatives. "I'm sure Dad could swim his way out," said Nanda Ayurbaba, the 13-year-old daughter of the man who only hours before had sent the choppy video. The crash triggered the well-worn machinery of accident investigations, dominated for decades by Boeing and American regulators. The National Transportation Safety Board and the venerable plane maker both dispatched teams to Jakarta, and at the FAA office near Seattle, a modernist edifice surrounded by embankments on all sides to deter car bombers, staffers began dissecting what went wrong. They called in Boeing engineers, who explained about automated software known as the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, or MCAS. Only a few people at the FAA had even heard of it. "What's MCAS?" asked one agency official. It was immediately clear that the software was far more powerful than Boeing had suggested in documents submitted to win the plane's approval. The engineers had drastically underestimated the software's ability to move the horizontal stabilizer, the small wing on the plane's tail. What's more, it had fired because of bad data from the single misaligned sensor.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?